17. So he already has a track record of meddling in Muslims' affairs. And a key thing to remember is that Karnataka's government is made up of 25 BJP seats out of 28 since the 2019 election, and that's actually up from 17 seats in the 2014 election. Why do I mention that? It's because the BJP's propaganda is clearly very effective in Karnataka, and part and parcel of the BJP propaganda is a genocidal scapegoating of Muslims to hide their own failures. So I'm sorry to sound pessimistic, but if the Supreme Court's final ruling is not Islamophobic enough to the ears of BJP and RSS supporters, then they will whip themselves up into a frenzy on the streets of Karnataka. And it's not only in India we've seen this before, we've even seen something similar here on the streets of Britain.
Mr. Hussain, what about the Indian celebrities and journalists which have faced criticism for speaking on anti-hijab rights in Iran while keeping silent on the hijab ban in India? Doesn't this seem like a case of hypocrisy and double standards?
Yeah, whatever your view on the hijab itself, you can't claim to be against authoritarianism in one situation and be silent on the other. That's just hypocrisy. And if it's rooted in ignorance, then that celebrity or journalist needs to be embarrassed. But if it's rooted in some kind of political or religious bigotry, then that person needs to be shamed. Because women's rights should not be used by politicians or political movements for cheap political points.
Last but not least, Mr. Hussain, why don't Muslim girls fighting the draconian ban on hijab in India have enough voices supporting them, and why do Indian celebrities refrain from criticizing their government?
Being a celebrity is about being popular. It's about being fickle enough to just go with the flow. And politics in India have made Muslims very unpopular. So it's really not surprising to see them supporting the regime's perspective on Muslims and Muslim issues. But the bigger problem here that we have with Muslims supporting Muslims, it's not just in India either. The big problem we have with the Muslim community is that we are like, you know, sheep looking out for a shepherd to look after us. What we do is we expect this shepherd to look after everything for us, to defend us, speak up for us, and so on. But what we forget is that every shepherd is just trying to grow his sheep and one day lead them to slaughter. We Muslims, we must not be sheep anymore. Our sisters in India are doing the brave and terrifying work of standing up to the Islamophobia of an entire country. The least we can do, we Muslim men and women around the world, is to speak up for them, be their voice, as well as elevating their own voice too.
There you have it, Mr. Ahmed Hussain, spokesperson for the Muslim Public Affairs Committee from the UK. It's always glad to have you with us, Mr. Hussain. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Former Pakistani diplomat Asif Durrani says West wants to take undue advantage of situation in Iran, asserting that if they are so concerned, they should give freedom of choice to Muslim women in France and India. Journalist and commentator Sayed Zafar Mehdi calls out hypocrisy of Indian celebrities such as Priyanka Chopra, who have the temerity to back anti-hijab protests in faraway Iran but refrain from condemning the hijab ban in their own country.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The Indian government has scrapped the controversial rule granting voting rights to new residents of Jammu and Kashmir after a massive backlash in the Himalayan region, with local political parties dubbing it a bid to alter the contested region's demography. The rule was scrapped only 2 days after being introduced in one of the 20 districts in the region. It allowed Indian citizens living in Kashmir for a year or more to register as voters, replacing a rule that restricted the franchise only to permanent residents.
Following widespread anger and outrage, India's Hindu nationalist government on October 13th decided to scrap a contentious rule that granted voting rights to new residents in Jammu and Kashmir region. Local authorities said the measure introduced just 2 days before had been withdrawn and was to be treated as void without providing further details. It came 2 months after the Narendra Modi-led BJP government in New Delhi announced that around 2.5 million voters are expected to be added to the voter list in the region, which would increase the electorate by more than a third from 7.6 million presently. The announcement sparked angry and spontaneous protests in the Muslim-majority Himalayan region, with political parties unanimously denouncing the move, fearing demographic changes. In a tweet last week, the region's former chief minister, Mehbooba Mufti, accused New Delhi of creating religious and regional divisions in Kashmir, saying the attempts must be thwarted. She had previously described the move to allow non-locals to vote as the last nail in the coffin of electoral democracy in the region, equating the BJP government with Nazi Germany and Israel. Mufti's political rival and former chief minister, Omar Abdullah, also decried the move, accusing the BJP of importing voters to win power in Kashmir.
India stripped the disputed Himalayan region of its semi-autonomy in August 2019, reorganizing the erstwhile Jammu and Kashmir state into two federally administered territories. It also introduced changes in the constitution to allow non-locals to vote in the elections and buy properties in Kashmir. Before 2019, voting rights were limited to permanent residents only, guaranteed under Article 370 of the Indian Constitution. The law also barred Indians from outside Kashmir from permanently settling, buying land, and holding local government jobs in the region.
The decision to allow voting rights to non-local Kashmiris living temporarily in the region has ignited anger and fury in recent months, stoking fears of yet another attempt by the Hindu nationalist government in New Delhi to dilute the Muslim-majority region's demography. Among the new voters included Indian Army personnel, government and private sector employees, and migrant workers, as authorities had declared there was no need for an Indian citizen to have a domicile certificate or to be a permanent resident to get enlisted as a voter in the region. It was seen by local political parties and civil society groups as a cunning ploy to redraw the electoral map and change the region's demography. Since August 2019, when Kashmir's semi-autonomous status was abrogated, a series of laws have been introduced to allow the Hindu nationalist BJP to gain a foothold in the Muslim-majority region. As per the Indian government's last census in 2011, Kashmir had a total population of about 12.5 million, of which Muslims comprised 68.31% and Hindus 28.43%. Some pundits see the BJP government's decision to add non-locals to the voting list in the region as the final solution to the long-standing dispute, which has seen India and Pakistan go to war at least three times.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Zia Ahmed, the editor-in-chief of the Sri Lankan Muslim Times. Welcome to the program, Mr. Ahmed. Now, the Indian government has for now scrapped the rule that granted voting rights to non-local Kashmiris in Kashmir. Is this U-turn the result of growing anger and outrage in the region?
There is widespread anger amongst Kashmiris within the region, as well as in the Kashmiri diaspora spread all over the world, for Indian government's oppression of Kashmiris and violation of their human rights. Yes, this U-turn may be, due to the fact that the Hindu nationalist government has realized that they have crossed the red line by granting voting rights to the non-Kashmiris in Kashmir. And this blatant move may inflame the situation further in the region. Moreover, the BJP government is also preparing for a number of state elections, as well as the national election in 2024. And strategically, they may have thought to calm the situation down in Kashmir and elsewhere in the rest of India, and against the criticism of minorities within India itself.
Mr. Ahmed, the popular opinion in the Himalayan region points to apprehensions amongst people that the Hindu nationalist government in India wants to change the region's demography. I want to see your assessment on this.
Moreover, the BJP government is also preparing for a number of state elections, as well as the national election in 2024. And strategically, they may have thought to calm the situation down in Kashmir and elsewhere in the rest of India, and against the criticism of minorities within India itself. Kashmir is a disputed region between India and Pakistan, and it was for the indigenous people of Kashmir to decide whether they wanted to stay within the Union of India or opt to merge with Pakistan in accordance with the United Nations Resolution in 1947. But unfortunately, on 27th of October, which is observed as a black day by the Kashmiris, since on this day, 75 years ago, India took control of state of Jammu and Kashmir militarily, with the promise of self-determination of Kashmir through a plebiscite of referendum. Now, it has been almost three quarters of a century that India has reneged on its promise for the legitimate rights of Kashmiris to hold a plebiscite and have their self-determination, whether they want to stay with India or to merge with Pakistan or even to stay independent. Now, India has been, over all these 75 years, did not hold this plebiscite or referendum. And now they have blatantly annexed Kashmir without any consultation. Now, India has occupied Kashmir with its first fist of its iron fist of his military, and gradually making moves to change the demography of this only Muslim-majority state in the country by settling non-Kashmiris in Kashmir, and eventually to dilute the indigenous religious, cultural, and linguistic nature of the Kashmiris' ethnic majority.
Last but not least, since August 2019, a series of measures have been taken by the BJP government in New Delhi to integrate Kashmir with the Indian Union. And now, how do you sense the mood in the region today?
So the Kashmiris have been seeking self-determination since 1947, which Indian government has not allowed, in spite of the promises made through the United Nations. And now, blatantly in August 2019, the BJP government virtually annexed Kashmir with a large influx of military in the region, which was already the largest militarized region in the whole world. They put more military there, and they knew that there were going to be opposition by the Kashmiri people, but they basically shut everybody within their houses, and then especially with the pandemic, COVID-19 coming in as well, they really oppressed the Kashmiris, that they could not hold any rallies or show any opposition to the government's move. The mosques were closed, and they're closed now and then. Again, the freedom of movement, the freedom of expression, even educational institutions get closed now and then. So they are really completely shutting the say and the wishes of the Kashmiri people and oppressing them. It is very similar to just like an occupying power, what the Israelis have done in Palestine, where they have completely took control of the indigenous people and violated their human rights and completely disregarded their rights of self-determination, just like Israelis have done to Palestinians. The same textbook copy is being perpetrated in the region of Kashmir as well. And of course, India and Israel collaborate with each other on these issues gradually and globally. If people want to understand, it's a very similar situation what is in Palestine with oppression by the Israelis. The Indian government is enacting the same kind of oppression in Kashmir as well. In addition to that, the BJP government is a Hindu nationalist government, and it wants to create a Hindu nation in India and eventually oppressing its minorities into submission. And even there is a danger that if these moves are not stopped, there might be a genocide of minorities, especially Muslims, in India. And India, Muslim population is very big. There are about 200 million Muslims out of, say, a billion Indians. It's not that easy to submit or wipe them out through genocide. What they will do is they will make the position of Muslims in India and especially in Kashmir unbearable, miserable, and very hard to live in India. And that is going to be a problem not only for India, but it's going to be a problem for the whole world if this kind of oppression is allowed to take place in India and especially in Kashmir.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Zia Ahmed, the editor-in-chief of the Sri Lankan Muslim Times. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Sayed Samer Abbas, a Pakistani journalist, says India was forced to withdraw the controversial law designed to change the demography of Kashmir, commending the efforts of the region's political leadership. Journalist Raisa Wickramatun quotes from an article by Maknoon Wani that the long-standing conflict in Kashmir cannot be brushed aside while making critical decisions about the territory. Arif Ayub, a Mumbai-based activist, asserts that India has not helped its cause by scrapping Article 370, adding that Kashmir's demography is being mutilated to eradicate its Muslim majority status.
And that was our episode about the hijab ban in India and the hypocritical stance of Indian celebrities on the issue. And also, the Indian government's decision to scrap the rule allowing non-resident Kashmiris to vote in the region. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B,
and Iran Sadr-Bad 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. Stay tuned. Understanding the language of the Quran with our own personal wording is impossible. This way, we'll be trapped by our own misunderstandings. The term warad in Farsi language means to enter or entrance, while in the language of the Quran, it means to be on the verge of or to be beside something.
میگه این من کم الا وارد و همه شما میاد بر لبه جهنم قرار.
So when in the Holy Quran some people are referred to as those who enter the hellfire, it doesn't mean to enter the hell, but to be on the verge of hellfire. Even the people of paradise are on the verge of hellfire. It is exactly like the magnetic which absorbs some and leaves some others. Therefore, our deeds on the Day of Judgment will move us to hell or heaven. We are all on the verge of entering the hell fire. So it is very much good to understand the Quran based on its own wording.
ف
Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojjatul Islam Ranjbah. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
In the limelight. The charter airline that was hired by the British government to remove asylum seekers to Rwanda has pulled out of the scheme following a wave of public pressure in Britain. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. A charter airline hired to remove people seeking refuge in the United Kingdom to Rwanda has pulled out of the scheme after pressure from campaigners. A plane operated by Privilege Style first attempted to fly asylum seekers to the East African country in June, but was grounded by an 11th-hour ruling by the European Court of Human Rights. The Mallorca-based carrier had become known as the UK government's airline of the last resort for its willingness to conduct deportation flights that other airlines refused. But after an email campaign by torture survivors and refugee organisations, Privilege Style has said it will no longer operate flights to Rwanda. The development will leave the British government in a fix. Two other charter airlines that previously conducted deportation flights, Titan Airways and Air Tanker, have already ruled themselves out of the scheme. In a letter to the charity Freedom from Torture, which has led the campaign under the hashtag #StopTheFlights, Privilege Style said it hereby wishes to communicate the following, that it will not operate flights to Rwanda in the future, that it has never flown to Rwanda since the one flight scheduled for June of 2022, which is the reason for this controversy, was suspended. The United Kingdom signed a £120 million deal with the Rwandan government back in April to outsource the UK's asylum system as it sought to find a solution to a growing number of refugees entering the United Kingdom via small boats in the English Channel. The deal meant people who had arrived in the United Kingdom by irregular means, such as by small boat, could be forced onto a charter plane and flown to the East African country of Rwanda. It was criticised by human rights organisations because of Rwanda's record as an authoritarian state that repeatedly imprisons, tortures and murders alleged political opponents. Privilege Style's statement followed an escalation in public protests against it by campaigners. Last week, activists from Freedom from Torture presented the firm with Worst Airline of the Year award at the carrier's headquarters in Palma, Mallorca, in front of the media. According to the carrier, its VIP customers include several Spanish companies and top Spanish football clubs. Campaigners targeted privileged style outside the Real Madrid versus Barcelona football match last week in Madrid, holding banners reading, "Don't fly with privileged style while they profit from refugees' pain." No flights have taken off yet to Rwanda because of legal challenges in the High Court. On 14th of June, a privileged style Boeing 767 was due to take seven asylum seekers to Kigali in Rwanda from a military airport at Boscombe Down in Wiltshire. The day before, it had taken tourists from Tenerife, Spain, to Dusseldorf in Germany. But the flight, which cost the British taxpayer about £500,000, was cancelled at the last minute, following a decision by the European Court of Human Rights. Liz Truss, the outgoing British Prime Minister, had pledged to continue the scheme. Candidates considering running to be Prime Minister, including Rishi Sunak, Penny Mordaunt and Boris Johnson, are expected to support the deportations. The British newspaper The Daily Mail also has details about the same story. An airline hired by the British government to deport migrants from the United Kingdom to Rwanda has pulled out of the scheme following controversies surrounding it and backlash from human rights campaigners. Privileged Style was due to remove people to Rwanda in June for the first time under the government's new immigration policy. But the flight was grounded at the last minute after intervention by the European Court of Human Rights. The Mallorca-based airline had faced calls and public demonstrations urging it to abandon the arrangement and today confirmed it would not put on any more flights to Rwanda. In a major blow to the British government's policy, the airline has now described the controversy surrounding the episode and pledged to never attempt to fly migrants to Rwanda again. In a statement, the operator said, "It's important for us to clarify that we will never operate the flight to Rwanda since the one scheduled in June of 2022. The reason for this controversy was suspended and never flew. That we don't operate flights to Rwanda in the future." Freedom from Torture, which led the campaign, said it had received a letter from the airline detailing the decision, in which it also asked the charity to now cease actions against our brand. Kolbasia Hasu, who fled torture in Central Africa and now works for the charity, described the news as a victory for people power after activists stood up against the British government's cruel Cash for Humans Rwanda scheme. With privileged style pulling out, the wheels are coming off the British government's dodgy Rwanda deal. Whoever succeeds Liz Truss as Prime Minister should put an end to this inhumane plan once and for all, he added. Last week, activists stood outside Privilege Airlines headquarters in Palma de Mallorca with a banner reading "Worst Airline Award Winner" in both Spanish and English. The withdrawal of the operator, which became known as the government's airline of the last resort, has prompted questions over which airline could be used to operate the government flights should they go ahead. Two other charter airlines that previously conducted deportation flights, Titan Airways and Air Tanker, have already ruled themselves out of the scheme. The Home Office said it does not comment on operational matters, but that the government remained committed to the Rwanda policy. The then Home Secretary Priti Patel announced the £120 million deportation deal back in April in a bid to curb channel crossings by people in small boats. Since then, at least 32,300 have made the journey. The legality of the arrangement has been contested in the courts of law, with ministers and campaigners awaiting a ruling from High Court judges on the case. The first flight in June was halted following an 11th-hour intervention by the European Court of Human Rights. The plans has also faced condemnation from public figures, including the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welsby, who said, "Deporting asylum seekers should shame us as a nation." The outgoing Prime Minister Liz Truss had vowed to stand by the plan, as did Rishi Sunak and other candidates who ran to become Conservative Party leader over the summer. So far this year, more than 37,500 migrants have arrived in the United Kingdom after crossing the Channel, according to government figures. This includes over 4,500 this month alone. But the Ministry of Defence, the MOD, has not recorded any arrivals in the UK since Tuesday amid poor weather conditions at sea. The Home Office spokesperson said, "We remain committed to our world-leading migration partnership with Rwanda, which will see those who come to the United Kingdom through dangerous, illegal and unnecessary routes relocated to Rwanda to rebuild their lives in that country."
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. A child is like a white paper on which you can write good things or bad things. Entire personality of a child is developed by the parents, by the upbringing they do. And in this program, we try to provide all the necessary information that is required to bring up your child in the best possible way. The answers of your questions are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University and researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor Nakavi, in our previous episodes, we have been talking about the developments of a child, and we said in a physical development, in a cognitive development, and in emotional development, these developments should not become barriers for other developments, especially emotional aspect of parents or trainers should not become a barrier for the cognitive development of a child. Would you like to add more to the topic?
As far as this development goes, it's all intertwined. You can't separate it, of course, but you can focus on certain areas. As we talk about cognitive development, a child, for example, starts off with numbers and shapes and colors, and there should be an environment where he or she is able to understand these things,
yeah,
in an informal way while playing. When we talk about the kindergarten Montessori form of education, it says that we're talking about learning while playing. Whether we agree with the concept or not, that's different. But when we're at home and we want to teach our children, educate them and groom them, of course, cognitive development, as is physical development or even emotional development, it starts from the womb of the mother.
Yeah.
So certain things have to be taken care of, as I mentioned before, what the mother is thinking about, how she's feeling, what she's eating. Everything has an effect on the child in the womb. So that is one very important thing that we have to take care of. And what we should be doing, we should learn how to do that, proper things to be eaten.
So even in cognitive development, you're saying it does not start where a child starts understanding things.
Exactly. Cognition, understanding. Certainly, there's a certain level of cognition in that realm. We cannot say that's completely not there. But when a child is born and the conditions are much more in your control, you need to develop an environment where it becomes conducive for his learning and cognitive development.
True.
And for every specific age, for every level, there are certain things which have to be taught, whether it's numbers or shapes or colors or even gradually mathematical issues, arithmetic, and they can be done in a playful way.
Okay.
Reading book, then starts reading and listening. Everything has a role to play in the cognitive development of the human being. There are certain children who are better than others in mathematics.
Yeah.
Or in other, some are good in arts and the fine arts. Because their cognitive development has taken a different route at that beginning, the beginning of their lives. But we need to develop a general level of cognition. And then, of course, we certainly believe that cognition, development of cognition and skills, cognitive skills, goes hand in hand with emotions and physical development. But the emotions should not become a barrier and impede that growth. The emotions should be developed based on cognition.
All right.
Understanding. A child should be made to learn that, yes, one should be showing his feelings or her feelings, but there's a cognition behind that. There's something to be known beyond that.
All right.
Of course,
it should be within.
You can't philosophize with a child, but yeah, you have to make him understand and realize.
All right. Well, we'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Nakavi, and we're discussing what should be in the minds of parents and trainers while they are doing development. Emotions should not become barriers, especially in cognitive development. Well, Professor Nakavi, before going to the break, you said a very important point that a child, when he grows up tomorrow and he takes a certain field, some go for fine arts, some go for science, some go for mathematics, and this is what somewhere their cognitive skills have rooted from in the very early age of their life. But we have parents who often force their children in a very, like, I must say, in the, say, for example, after passing their 10th class exams, parents often come and they force their children, you have to go to a particular field because I want you to become a doctor or I want you to become an engineer. So you're suggesting for such parents that why not work from very beginning, develop his cognitive skills in a way that he himself chooses that field rather than you forcing him tomorrow?
Exactly. It should be a choice of his own. Of course, if you want to, him to become take up a certain profession in his future life, then the parents should take care that they are upbringing in such a way.
For provide example, that environment.
Right, provide that environment. I remember a person was talking about a personality who, while he was sitting in his home country in the subcontinent somewhere, he was saying, look, I have so many children. And he had 10, 12 children. He said, I will train two of my children to become people who are motivational speakers, who can educate people and go to the West to do that.
Okay.
And migrate to the West. So he, in his hometown, he provided them an environment where they were learning about the West and go for example, tabligh in the West. So all their upbringing was in such a way, such a fashion, that way they were becoming prepared for that.
Becoming a motivational speaker.
Speaker, for example, for the West. So they have to develop their language, they have to develop the understanding of that part of the world, the geography of that world, part of the world, the history of that part of the world. So many things have to be taken care of. So if you want your child to become an alim, for example, then you have to provide him such an environment.
Yeah.
If you want him to be a good, competent student even, you need to provide him that initial. I mean, you can't just allow him to grow up on his own without any grooming and allow him to go into the streets and just learn things without any control, without any guidance. That's not the proper way.
All right.
You can't, if you can't expect a child to become what you want without putting in that effort. So you need to develop that cognition. You need to develop that emotions. The emotions should be channelized towards the truth.
All right.
I mean, when we talk about faithful believers, believers who have faith and the love of God in their hearts, so that should come with that cognitive understanding that Allah is our Lord, is our Master, is our Creator. So gradually that understanding, cognitive understanding has to be developed, and which should lead to that emotional attachment to God.
Okay.
So we need to develop the emotions based on that cognitive learning.
All right. We'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Nakavi, and we are saying, when folding, what things you have to take care of while you're providing cognitive development to your child? Yes, Professor.
I mean, one of the most important things for a person to become a good, successful human being in future life is being a creative person.
Yeah.
A person who can carry out critical analysis of things, evaluate things, make good judgments. So you need to develop that. Most of the time, mostly when we are faced with questions from our children, we snub them because most of the times we don't know the answers.
Yeah.
Or when a child is, for example, is curious, he wants to break up something and open it up, we stop him from doing so. So that creativity is not developed. That critical analysis of things and evaluation of things is not developing.
All right.
So we need to provide that environment where this creativity is developed, along with the emotions, proper emotions, the attitude that what he wants to achieve, he should strive for it. He should work for it. He should take the pressure. He should take the trouble to do things. We shouldn't pamper children and we provide them everything that they need without them making the effort.
Yeah.
So we need to provide them the proper cognitive development, emotional development. Their love and hate should be focused and channelized towards the truth.
Okay.
We should make them love others, not just because they are your beloved ones, your siblings, or your... No, because they are human beings, and God Almighty has commanded us to respect all human beings, especially our parents. It's not because of that personal greed that I should be respected as a child, as a parent, or a child shouldn't feel that he has to be taken care of in any way possible and at any cost. No, he should feel that, yes, my parents love me. They are providing me with the things I need. I need to make an effort myself. So that attitude,
it's really hard to develop that attitude.
That is very important. That attitude
important.
To be able to face problems and troubles.
And even solve them. If the problems are there, a child should have the ability to solve them.
So he has the attitude first to be able to face issues in life, face problems in life. The child should not be, as I said, basic requirements are to be provided for, but many things have to be developed that the child goes out to do them himself or herself. He shouldn't all the time be looking upon his parents or elder siblings to do those things.
Yeah.
So the physical development comes in here, the nutrition comes here, the proper physical skills come in. From small chores, small household work that has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So starting from that and then going on to, for example, taking care of oneself.
All right. Thank you so much, Professor Nakavi. We have had a very good conversation. You made clear for us a lot of things that could unconsciously become barriers in our development. And listening to that was really helpful for me as a parent and definitely for other parents as well. Thank you so much to our listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you want to listen to our programs again, please go back to our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. If you have any questions, any suggestions, any comments for our program, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also search us on our social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. And when you go to our official website, parstoday.com, you'll find a tab, Call of Islam. Over there, you can find our programs. Until another session, fi amanullah, God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.